Welcome to the Solarity Report. Today's Thursday, March 19th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join us this evening. Tonight, we're going to go through the top stories in money and markets. We got some great questions from listeners in Ask Catherine, and then Michael Allwright of the Alaska Solarity Circle is going to join us for nuts and bolts of organizing a Solarity Circle. Because the material on the circle is long, we may go over, and I'm going to feel free tonight to just go as long as we need. But again, we're going to post the MP3 in the archive, so if you can't stay on, you can always get it later. It's a topic that you may want to listen to again. So we're also, after this evening, we're going to post the outline at the link section that we sent you in the reminders today. So you have a link to a page in the library, which is subscriber only, and it's different sort of materials and information on Solarity Circle, and we'll post the outline that Michael and I used to cover it tonight, because again, this is material you might, if you're interested in doing a circle, you might want to go over it more than once. So with that, money and markets, every morning I get up early and I head off to the gym. And it's the only time I see the television, because I don't own a television and watch one, but they're pervasive in the gym. And so I sit on the treadmill, and it's reached the point where everything is a lie. And so it's really tricky if you're a busy person trying to figure out what in the world is going on, because you watch the news programs, and when it comes to the financial market, there's nothing that's true. Other than sort of the numbers that are expressed mathematically are, in fact, the numbers that are expressed mathematically. So let's go over some of the top stories. We've seen a very rapid drop of the dollar against the euro, against precious metals. We definitely have a dollar dropping. Probably the biggest story of the week is the Fed decision to purchase treasuries. What this means is they're monetizing the debt. So when the Treasury issues new debt, instead of selling treasuries to people abroad, ultimately what's happening is the Fed is just printing paper. And it's a very strong indication of inflation to come. And so the Fed has been fighting the drop in economic activities by simply printing dollars. The problem with the way the Treasury and the Fed are doing it, if you look at our current tally that we put up on the blog a week or two ago called Bailout Mo Money, you add this $1 trillion to what the list of items are, and we're looking at basically the combined Fed Treasury bailouts up to about $14 trillion. That's a tremendous amount of paper, and part of the problem is the paper is going to selected players. So there's no more real things in the economy, but there's $14 trillion more paper. And ultimately what that means is the prices of tangibles is going to go up. So there's more and more signals about inflation and moving out of a deflation into inflation. I've talked a lot about things like stockpiling on the Solarity Report. I've made a real effort over the last year to try and build up inventories of non-perishables, simply because if you look at the possibility of shortages or the possibility of the cost of goods rising rapidly in an inflationary period, it's just having lots of goods on hand of things that you're going to use over the next 2 years is really, you're better off with sitting with tangibles than sitting with paper. So Fed decision to purchase treasuries is ominous. The dollar index is down, and we may be at the beginning of a more rapid depreciation in the dollar. The dollar's been high. The dollar's been high because people have been pulling their money out of financial assets and parking it in cash. A lot of cash, this dollars have had to be bought to pay off dollar debts, but the surge that we've gotten from that may be over. So again, we could be on a precipice, and anybody who's holding a lot of dollars or paper, you need to think about whether you want to continue to do that or not. Another big story, AIG bonuses, and we're seeing a theme that's very important to understand, which is for any story that's inclined, or any truth that's inclined to upset people or destroy the legitimacy of the system, it's imperative to find a scapegoat and focus the attention on that scapegoat. So we're watching billions of dollars go to AIG, and AIG turn around and put that money into the very pockets of the people who engineered the frauds in the first place. Goldman Sachs, a lot of the big banks. I have a post up on the blog called Goldman Trough, and it lists the big recipients of the AIG bailout. Rather than have the press ask the question, where is all this money going? And moreover, when the initial frauds occurred, where did all that money go? I mean, we've fraudulently induced America. We've raped these communities. Where did that money go? Instead of asking about the big money, we're talking about the bonuses that the traders in London got. Now, I'm not saying it's not outrageous. I'm not saying it's a lot of money. But if you look at, for example, the bonuses that all the companies that got the bailout money through AIG have paid out, it's billions, not $165 million. And if you look at the sort of the money that's been stolen through the various frauds that are part and parcel of what AIG is paying out, it's much more. And if we were going to get money back, getting half of those bonuses back to AIG is nothing. Getting back the trillions that have been stolen, that's real money. But, of course, that's not the story, and that's part of why it's focused on the bonuses. Another perfect example is the seizure of Madoff and his wife's assets, when the question of, well, where is the $68 billion? It's now up to $68 billion that's missing. Where is it gone, and how do we get it back? Anybody who's read the blog or been part of the Saleri report has heard me say for years, where's the money, and how do we get it back? And what it's really important is you watch the news unfold, you want to constantly ask the question, where is the money, who got the money, and how do we get it back? So the story on Madoff is, where's the $68 billion and how do we get it back? The story on AIG is, where is trillions and how do we get it back? Because there's a very, if you look at all the mortgage fraud and the collateral fraud on the U.S. housing market, AIG is deeply entwined in that story. Now, where are we? I said at the year-end wrap-up that we had a shakeout that was going to happen this year. And two of the key dates, the big dates after the inauguration, was going to be March 15th, because that's the corporate tax date, and that's big disclosure dates. If you know, a lot of the corporations are filing their 10-Ks. Some of them have filed or are ready to file their annual proxies. We're having the pension funds come out with big announcements on losses. I put up a roundup today of the pension fund losses around the country. So big disclosure dates and corporate tax dates on March 15th. April 15th is individual tax dates, and that means people all over the country are working to prepare their taxes. I know I'm working to prepare my taxes. And if you are working to prepare your taxes and paying, particularly those of us who are paying tax preparers, to figure out how to file these complicated things, and it gets ever more complicated, you're sitting and staring and looking at writing a check that conceivably for some people means they can't afford to send their children to college or the college of their choice this year. And they know that they're going to send that money to Washington, and then Washington's going to give that money to AIG, and AIG is going to pay a bunch of traders who caused the problem $165 million. And it's very sensitive at a time like this, when a lot of news hits the legitimacy of the system, people in Washington get scared. They get scared that the system is going to lose its legitimacy and they're going to pull out of the market. Suddenly we see the market flying up. Wouldn't surprise me to see the Fed intervene and Treasury and the President's working group on markets, the so-called plunge protection team behind that. So you need to keep the markets up. People are upset about AIG and Madoff, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you do? Well, I just put a post up on the blog this afternoon called tax time covert ops. And it's really, we've been seeing sort of more and more spin coming out, sort of targeting certain groups, including groups that are known to be tax resistant. And I think we're going to see more and more spin that reflects the fear of what the leadership does and how they behave when they're afraid of a class war. So, you know, if you're worried about a class war, you start a race war. If you're worried about tax resistance, you sort of target patriot groups. And so we're seeing a greater level of fear in the system because people don't trust the system. And between now and April 15th, I think there's going to be increased tension and pressure. And so maybe, say, between now and May 1st, boy, now's the time to really practice your prayer and meditation and stay calm, because there are going to be a lot of tempers flaring. So those are sort of the stories of the week. And what they all talk about is the you know, for 60 years we've printed paper, the amount of real things, land, water, resources, hasn't changed, and now we're into the end game. How are we going to change how we behave? How are we going to change how we interact with our communities and our neighbors? How are we going to change our economic footprint? How are we going to unsuppress technology? These are all the questions that are coming into the end game. And rather than using the media to discuss and debate and process those questions, instead what we've got is sort of shrieking and spin. And so the issue for many of us is going to be, how do we start to engage in those how do we turn off the media and start to engage in those conversations? And that's part of what I hope the Solari Report is about and helps you be about as well. So that's it for Money and Markets. There's plenty of news. I keep thinking I'm going to post less top picks on the blog, and each week I just can't because there's so much going on. But the pig is going through the snake. So let's turn to questions. We got some great questions. So for Ask Catherine, there are three I wanted to address. One is, will geography determine viability? What are the safe places to live? Very good question. When my Solari Circle first formed in 2005, the first exercise we did together was we decided that we were a family of four, and we had $1 million in cash, and so we were going to figure out where we were going to live and then how we were going to invest our money. And so the first thing we did, we said, okay, well, where do we want to live? So we created criteria of what made a place desirable for us. And it was a fascinating experience and one I recommend to you. But, of course, what it came down to was a long list of what makes a place healthy in terms of resources, so food, water, shelter, climate, et cetera, and then what makes a place a community. And we talked recently with Albert Bates about transition towns. Transition towns is really a process methodology to help a community start to organize and deal with creating safety in an environment that is this uncertain, and the sort of the larger systems have become not reliable. And, you know, so we came up with a long list of sort of what makes community and then what makes for good resources. And finally, after a great discussion, chose of all places Asheville, Carolina. But one of the things we learned in that process is you can't find safety by going and picking it. In other words, we're dealing with phenomena which is global, and more or less it's happening everywhere. For example, one of my bugaboos is chemtrails. And if you don't know what chemtrails are, you can watch. There's a wonderful video up on YouTube called Aerosol Crimes that will describe chemtrails. If you study the chemtrail phenomena, what you find is it's a global phenomena, from what I can tell. And there are a few places where, because of the islands and wind patterns, it appears that chemtrails are not. But pretty much they're everywhere. And certainly I travel a fair amount. And if you look at the problems of centralized control and the use of technology to create centralized control, the phenomena is everywhere. So it's, you know, it's not that there's a place with a bubble and you can go live in the bubble and get away from all of this madness. And so safety, the question to ask is not where can I be safe? The question to ask yourself is where is it in my heart to help create safety? Because safety is something that we have in our faith and create with our actions. And so what you want to do is be about creating safety for you and your neighbors, but you want to pick those places where your heart is to do that. So, for example, I live in Hickory Valley because my family's here, part of my family, and I want to be near my family, and I want to be in a farming community. So this is, you know, this is the place in the world where I have family who are farmers. So think about what's in your heart and where it is you create safety, because safety really comes from community. And if you're about creating safety for others, what you'll find is they're about creating safety for you. And it's in that circulation of the things that make us safe that safety occurs. Okay, so that's it for safety. Another great question, overseas bank accounts, and this was triggered by the concern of the falling dollar. If I want to hold money in other currencies, where can I do it? Now, I'm a great believer in diversification of where you have your money. I'm sort of a squirrel, so a pod here and a pod there is a great idea. So the idea of having money in other currencies in other countries, I think, is generally a sound one, depending on what your assets are. There have been many more regulations and rules layered on during the 90s and in this decade that make it increasingly difficult for a citizen without a lot of resources, so without a million plus in money to spend on fees, to have a bank account in other countries. It can be done, but it's more and more difficult. It is much easier generally to have an investment account, which for your purposes, it just means you can park money, but you can't write checks. Interestingly enough, we had James Turk on at the first week of this month, and you can listen to that Solari report in the archives. You can hold money in about, I think it's up to 6 or 7 different currencies with a gold money account. So you can hold money in Swiss francs, French francs, euros, Canadian dollars, British pounds, U.S. dollar, obviously. So if you want to go back and forth between silver and gold and different currencies, you can, or just park money in currencies there. So look for an investment account, not a bank account, and then, or again, gold money is an alternative. But I think the idea of parking money in different places in different jurisdictions makes a lot of sense. Then the third question, great question, what is the future going to look like? This was inspired by somebody watching my speech at the Barter Association and saying that the future was going to look very different than what most people expected. If you run through top picks, and I'll probably have an article about this, we're seeing a whole rash of bills coming in and they often have the word safety. Now, it's always fair to assume that the corporate news and the TV news is, you know, everything is a lie. It's always good when Washington says something to assume it's the opposite. So if something says the food safety bill, then you can automatically assume it's about getting control of the food system and making it unsafe for us. Anyway, so there's been a rash of bills. There's been gun safety, food safety. There's the healthcare database, and literally when you read all these bills, and there's a ton of them, what they are proposing to do is to basically digitize and control everything in amazingly micromanaging ways, and somebody can make a very good presentation that this makes a whole lot of sense in the world. And so what you realize is what you're basically going to do is destroy all the small players and small business with regulation that is, you know, one, doesn't make food safer, but certainly makes being a small player much more expensive. That's number one. But number two, the reality is the enforcement is not done by a, I mean, the enforcement is essentially going to be done to the, you know, the 21st century of the Sheriff of Nottingham. And so it's one thing to give a rule to a legitimate government to enforce. It's another thing to turn it over to the Sheriff of Nottingham. So when I said that the future will look different than what people think, there is a group of people who are looking to centralize control in extraordinary and frightening ways. At the same time, I'm one of those people who believes that that process won't work, but they have a plan for our futures, and we need to create an alternative plan. And what you're seeing happen all around the world are people starting to gather and realizing there's no point in waiting for our governments and leaders. They're not going to help us. They're headed on a road that we don't like. And so now we're going to have to invent our own world. And, of course, the question is, if you, like me, sit down and say, well, you know, I'm going to, you know, we're going to invent an alternative, then you have to understand we're working with a blank slate, because the future that we want is the future we're going to invent. And that means embracing living with tremendous uncertainty and tremendous fluidity of, you know, of your environment. I always tell the story, it's one of my favorite stories. I used to have a farm in New Hampshire, a family farm, and there's a story there of the Vermont farmer. A guy got lost in Vermont, and he pulls over the side of the road and he asks a farmer, he says, you know, how do I get to town? And the farmer says, well, you go down the road here 1C, you take a right, you go 2C's, then you take a left, and you go 3C's, and then you'll be in town. And the guy said, well, thank you very much, I really appreciate that, but could you tell me what a C is? The farmer said, sure, a C is when you can see as far as you can see, that's 1C. And so, you know, I used to be one of those people who had a 5-year plan and a 3-year plan and a 2-year plan and a 1-year plan. Now I just have a plan for the next C, because by the time I get there, so much could change. You know, who knows what will happen. So so the key is I think if I could wish for anything in America, it would be that all of us who've not wanted to look at the pro-centralization team and see them clearly for what they are and understand that, you know, nothing coming out of Washington is going to be for our good, and nothing coming out of the media. You know, there's some entertaining stuff. There's a little bit here and there. But essentially, the vast majority of it is a lie, because its business model requires that it be a lie. I mean, that's basically the business model. The minute we can see that and face that, then we can go to work in inventing something new. So that's my sort of prayer. So the future is going to look very different. The middle class bubble is over in America. And we've gotten quite a ride, and now we're going to have to go to work and build something new, because our capital's been spent. So, you know, it's a huge change, and it's a lot to let go of. At the same time, if you embrace it and say, well, it is what it is, then we have an incredible opportunity, because now is the time for transformation, and now is our opportunity if we let go of, you know, life in the bubble and embrace the future. So with that, let me turn to one of the key ingredients, I think, to building the future, which is organizing, which is getting together and getting into it. And with that, I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to introduce Michael Allwright. Michael is someone I met in 2007. I went up to Alaska to speak at Bioneers. And Michael is a very competent project manager at an architectural and engineering firm in Anchorage, Alaska. He's been in Alaska with his wife and family for about 14 years coming up from California. And Michael, I'd started a Solari Circle in 2005, and then Michael started a Solari Circle in Alaska, the Alaska Solari Circle. And he and I have been in cahoots ever since, and he's agreed to join us tonight. Are you with us from your greenhouse, Michael?
I am, here in my warm greenhouse, Eagle River.
Well, why don't, let's just say a minute or two about Alaska Solari Circle and then my circle, first ever Solari Circle, and dive on in.
Great. Well, as you said, the Alaska Solarius Circle was started in November of 2007 following your keynote and workshop at the Bioneers in Alaska. It was essentially, it started as an invitation to continue the conversation that you began at your keynote in the workshop there. I sent an email out to the Bioneers listserv saying, hey, let's get together and talk about all of this amazing stuff that Catherine presented. And there was, you know, about 15 people who showed up, and we gathered regularly for a few weeks that turned into a few months. And over time, there were about 7 of us that finally stuck with it, stuck together, and decided to form a Solarius Circle based on that continuing conversation. And we're a fairly diverse group of folks, people who work at the university. We have a craftsman. We have retired folks who used to work in the government, people who work in the medical industry. And, you know, aside from the craftsman who had some experience in real estate and also as a business owner, amazingly enough, we all had minimal financial experience. I mean, it was all basically our own individual experience around 401ks or working with brokers on how to invest here or there. So it was really a group of individuals who knew very little and were really inspired by what you had to say at the workshop. And our group is really place-based. We're all in or around Anchorage, and we gather on a weekly basis to primarily work on education and action, educating ourselves and looking at what we can do within our community.
Although you've gone through all your, for the members who have liquid securities portfolios, you've gone through all your portfolios to related to what you're doing, what you're learning and what you're doing.
Absolutely. As part of a coming clean, ongoing coming clean exercise, we went through each individual member's portfolios to look at ways that we could shift from the tapeworm bubble economy into more of a real economy. And for those assets that couldn't be moved out, you know, we looked at ways of putting them into things that looked safer on the near-term horizon.
Right. Well, I started my circle in 2005, and there weren't enough people. I couldn't find a group here in Hickory Valley that wanted to do it at the time, although the part of the idea for doing circles was inspired by one of my neighbors who came over one day, and she said, you know, I don't think Social Security is going to be there for us. We need to make alternative plans. Could you put together a group? So we tried to find one, and finally I really felt the need to not be alone in understanding the environment and doing plans. So I put together a group of people around North America, and we meet by phone once a week. And we, after doing simulations for a year, we put together a formal legal structure and started to invest together. So we've pooled capital, and we have a brokerage account and are doing liquid investment and have been together since then. So we're going on 4 years now. Well, Michael, now that we've talked about our circles, why don't we talk about what is a Solarius Circle?
That's terrific. Well, you know, I think from what's out there, it's really, as you always say, that's ethical conspiracy that's focused on financial education and action and investment with the purpose to really reduce our individual and collective risks and build the wealth for the circle members in a way that allows us to really invent this transformation that you were just talking about earlier.
I was really shocked when I had spent my career on Wall Street and then in Washington, and I was very used to people forming conspiracies, including ethical conspiracies. I came from a world where if you didn't like something, you gathered a group of people and you threw in some money and you just, you know, you took action. And it was very easy. And then when I ended up leaving Washington and kind of living around the country, I discovered that there was a real reticence about coming together and collaborating and using real money. It is almost like people had been taught to turn their power over to their broker or financial planner and not exercise it themselves.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that I have found really powerful in the circle is this development of intimacy around finances. And, you know, a number of us have talked about how creating this group to support each other in understanding and empowering ourselves around our finances has been an incredible asset. And that group, that conspiracy, even if it's just the few of us, has really built strength around that.
Right. In the 90s, I was financed my first community venture fund. So what I was hoping was communities would organize, you know, because right now, if you look at the capital in any community, all the money's going up to Wall Street, and then it's only coming back in certain ways. And so the question was, well, let's start to circulate capital, because the big businesses were taking over all the, you know, they're basically stripping communities, and small businesses were going under because small businesses had such a high cost of capital. And part of it was we're sending all of our capital to Wall Street, and then it's not coming back. So our own businesses are starved. So I thought, okay, well, let's do venture funds. And then we ran into, as you know, political opposition against that. And I stepped back and I said, okay, well, where's the politically feasible pathway to make circulating equity local possible? And the first thing I discovered was I can't begin to even think about local investment if I've got all my money in a 401k or IRA in a brokerage account. I don't think it's safe. So the first thing I have to do is get my money safe. And then the second thing I need to do is I need to understand a lot about a lot of things before I can even think about circulating money other than just shipping it to Wall Street. And nobody can do that alone. You know, it's too much stuff. And the funny thing is, if you, you know, for many years I went from place to place and I would give speeches, what I found is the people most passionate about making these kinds of changes were the ones least involved with finance or money. So you had the people most committed to change who were the ones who didn't have the tools. And the idea of a circle was they needed a vehicle to come together. You know, if you couldn't do a business fund or a venture fund among the businesses unless the citizens in those places who were willing to shift their capital had a way of organizing and learning and doing this in a way that was sound and healthy for them. And so part of the circles was to be that building block. And I stepped back and I said, you can't do a venture fund. You need this other building block, which is part anthropology and part, you know, safety and part risk management and part something else.
Exactly. And all of that is, I think, for us has been possible. And again, we've just been doing the education and are moving into action and looking towards getting into actual investment. But a lot of what we've done has been based on being able to come together as a group, building that intimate trust so that we're not doing it alone and we feel safe doing it together. And allow us to look forward to some really exciting opportunities. You know,
right, in our culture, we never talk about our money.
No, and it's amazing how it's just been a really powerful experience in many ways around that, to see the other circle members and feel it myself, you know, experience it myself, that it is so powerful to go and talk about our finances and not feel alone, especially
right.
in today's climate. It is just really scary, and I couldn't imagine, you know, if I hadn't done this a year ago, where I would be now and how tuned out I would be, because I would be so full of fear and sort of lost in the jungle, if you will,
right.
About what's going on right now. But
right.
Instead, as a group, we've really been able to come together and support each other in the learning process to understand what's happening and to take power around that. And it's just been fabulous.
There are three phases to doing a Solari circle, sort of three scopes. One is, the first one is coming together and coming clean, and the second is education in action, and then the third is investing. Now, we're not going to go into investing tonight, although we've posted, we created a library, and we posted links, including two documents that I just want to briefly describe before we go into the organization section. Two documents related to investment. One is an LLC structure, and the terms and conditions of it are very much like the first ever Solaris Circle. It's really designed for liquid investment, but it's an operating agreement and for an LLC that does liquid investment as essentially an investment group together. And then the second is one that hasn't been tried, but that I've developed with my attorneys. And if anybody uses it, you need to see your own attorneys and vet it for your state, because every state's different. But it's a structure that could be used to pool capital if you wanted to do non-liquid investment, which is typically what the local investment. You can do liquid local investment, but there's a lot more opportunity, I think, on the non-liquid side. And Michael, you pointed out something to me which I think is important. You found reading those, if I'm not mistaken, useful to helping you think through some of the organizing issues that you, and sort of the ways you organize for the first two phases, even though you weren't going to do investment, because they brought up some of the issues of running a group that deals with money, and also some of what you're going to need if you do ultimately go to investment.
Yeah, for us it was a terrific exercise to go through. We were kind of at a point where we were toying with the idea of, okay, well, we've gone through education, we're kind of getting into action now. Some of us were, you know, we thought we were ready to get into doing some investing, and it was like, okay, let's go through this LLC structure. And we didn't have a real, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, we didn't really have a structure, a terms of agreement and a structure for how we operated together at that time. And we thought, well, maybe we can use that to provide some structure to our group too, and got into it, and it was an amazing eye-opening experience for some of us. It was like,
right,
wow.
And I should note that there are kinds of investments you can do, and angel groups do them, where there's no shared agreement or legal structure. You just you look at things and individuals write a check or they don't. You know, it's much more loose.
Right.
So you don't have to go to this kind of formal structure to start dealing with money, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But I
that's
think
kind of where we landed was,
right.
You know, we realized we don't need this structure, and we're glad that we did this, because it showed us sort of a vision for what could happen in the future and a way to you know, initiate some investment, but later. And we realized
right.
We still had more education to go.
Right. For somebody who's never done investment together, particularly the LLC for non-liquid, is like a, you know, a whole bucket of cold water.
It woke us up.
Okay, well, let's talk about coming together and coming clean. The first question, of course, in coming together is your membership, identifying the optimal group. And a Solaris Circle is 12 people or less. We're trying to develop intimacy. So now you're 7, and first ever Solaris Circle is 10. And so I'd love to hear what you think is the optimal size.
We're 7, and sometimes during meetings we're 4. And I think that when we're together as the full group, that there's a lot more synergy, there's a lot more energy. It's nice sometimes when it is just a few folks too, because we can do a little more checking in and have some more individual conversation. But you know, fewer than 7, I think you miss out on some opportunities for synergy. If some people don't show up, then you do get into the lower numbers. And just for me, I think having fewer than 7 could make it difficult to break through some inertia. And we're actually at a point now where we are looking to open up our group to some folks that we have identified in order to grow our group and bring in some fresh and innovative ideas and some energy. So I think that you know, being 7 to 10 is probably a good number. But it's really going to be unique for each group. You know, if you can only find 5 people to get together and do this work with, then 5 people is the perfect number.
Right. Right. I think the thing to underscore is the advantages of not being alone.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It makes absolutely a tremendous difference.
And I think you also, you know, there are some risks in being too big if what you're doing is inviting people that you may not know so well or that others may not know so well.
Right. And there's a spectrum. You know, there's 2 models. One is where you start with people you know but don't know well, and the other is you start with people you really trust very thoroughly. Because you're going to be sharing information which is private information, it's confidential information, and it needs to stay that way. And the more a group of people can trust each other to keep that information either among themselves or whoever they as a group agree to share it with, it's very, very important. So if you haven't, you know, if you don't have a strong bond, you want to build that strong bond, and that's another reason to stay in the education phase until you're confident about that.
Absolutely. Yep. Well, and that gets to establishing a well-defined terms of agreement once you have identified the people in your group. And, you know, that terms of agreement would include things like, you know, privacy clauses and how you work and relate to each other both in the group and outside of the group.
Right, and I think there are a couple of critical issues. One is, are you going to have people who are just in your place you're going to meet in person, like your circle, or would you rather do it by phone? Do you want to network with people in your network who are in different places, and then do you want to have phone meetings?
Mm-hmm.
So I think those are 2 of the critical issues. And the other critical issue is, do you want people who are interested in liquid investment or people who are interested in non-liquid investment? So, for example, some people are just interested in local investment, which is going to tend to be non-liquid.
Yeah.
Some people, and perhaps I should define liquid versus non-liquid. Liquid would be something that's easily bought or sold at minimal transaction costs. So a bank CD or a stock or a precious metal coin is liquid. Non-liquid is a private equity investment into a local small business or something that's not easily transacted or to transact it could change the value. The transaction fees could be significant, like a piece of real estate, which is more liquid than private equity, but not as liquid as, say, a bank deposit. So it's good to know what kind of investments that you're interested in, and if the circle is successful and goes where it goes, where is that going to be?
Well,
another thing is
really actually important is setting the intention of the group early on.
Right.
And I would say that even before you want to talk about liquid versus non-liquid, it's, are we an education and action group that is eventually going to move to liquid, non-liquid investment? Or are we a group that's going to stay in education and action and not actually move on to investing? Because I think that there could be some groups that decide really what they want to do is just focus on education and action for a longer period of time than other people who may want to move more quickly into investing, and that you really need to identify that intention early on so that you don't have half of the group who's interested or wanting to pull back and stay within education and action. Inciting a different feeling out of the other half that's really chopping at the bits to move on and into investing.
One of the things we found was there was people who were financially sophisticated,
mm-hmm.
were very literate in finance, and were frustrated with people who weren't financially sophisticated.
Exactly.
But what was interesting is the people who were financially not sophisticated had their feet planted on real ground. And so if you're trying to get back to a world where you're investing in real assets, the financially unsophisticated people would say, well, I don't understand, where that goes and how that works. And what you would discover is the financially sophisticated person was used to running around in a bubble and really didn't know where things were going and what they were doing. And so if you could get financially sophisticated people who were patient with the people who weren't, and then financially unsophisticated people who understood how the real world worked, who were patient with the financial, you know, if you could get that integration going, then you got a very much more powerful result.
Sure.
So
well,
I think
that goes a lot to talking about, you know, having diversity of experience within your group, too.
Right.
You know, as I mentioned before, our group has a number of folks who are, you know, we're all professionals, if you will, and have a certain level of savvy in working with other people and integrating across a fairly diverse array of experiences. But none of us had any, or I should say, not all of us, but many of us were financially illiterate. And it would have been really helpful, I think, to have some people who were financially literate to you know, up our game a little bit.
Right.
And but you know, it's not just, I guess, sort of the people with diverse experiences, whether it's project management or investment or accounting, but as you're saying, also people with real world experience that can really bring a lot of value to a group.
Right. Now, meetings, you know, one of my theories is always that you need to have dinner. but there are obviously a lot of different ways you can do meetings. One is in person, one is by phone. Then, it could be weekly, it could be biweekly, it could be monthly. And I know you've come to a different kind of pattern because you're doing a sort of a dinner meeting, and then you're doing a coffee meeting.
Yes. We originally were meeting evenings for the first, I think, about 6 months or so. And then we moved it because it was it's challenging. It was fabulous because we would get together and, you know, 3 hours would fly by and we'd go, oh, geez, okay, well, this has been great, but I suppose we ought to go home to our families and get on with things. Which is really easy to do. And we went to a meeting every other week for 2 or 3 hours at a member's home, and she graciously would make dinner for everyone, fabulous food, and then the other two alternate weeks, we meet for an hour at a local health food store that has a little sort of a cafeteria area, and sit for an hour and basically do more of a check-in, whereas the evening sessions have been more around going out and doing activities or having a guest speaker or, you know, listening to audios or something that allows us to spend more time and really immerse ourselves in a topic.
So the moral of the story is it pays to have a great cook.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine, I cannot tell you how important having food is.
I agree.
It allows people to come in and sit down, something about the breaking of the bread with each other that really grounds a meeting. And when it's fabulous food, all the more.
It's interesting that a lot of the ideas that are coming back from various circles about local investing, you know, most of them center around food.
Right.
We had one circle up in upstate New York come back with the CSA wanted to produce more boxes of food, and the food co-op wanted to buy them. So the circle came up with a deal where they would finance the memberships, and then the food co-op would buy and market it for them. It's quite intriguing. But a lot more of the ideas come up around food.
Right.
Now, how did you determine roles? You have a pretty sort of flexible structure. Who's responsible for what?
Yeah, we don't really have roles, and that was one of the things that was a little. It wasn't challenging at first because I think that it really sort of fit our dynamic. I was maybe sort of the post facto leader, just because I was the one who got the ball rolling, but we didn't, someone would take notes and and kind of share them, and sometimes we'd send them out to each other, and sometimes, you know, everybody was sort of taking their own notes, that capturing things that were really relevant to them. Again, you know, I think one of the things that we were looking towards when we went through that LLC structure was, hey, well, maybe we'll get some structure out of this. And as we went through, we decided, you know, we're not there, and we still don't really need this structure.
Right. It's a lot of structure.
Yeah, we don't need a lot of structure. But what we do want is, you know, an agreement that will revisit every 3 or 6 months how often we meet, where we meet, and just do a check-in to see how things are going with folks. So it's a lot less structured than things that I have done before and others in the group, and we are were amazed at the point where we actually didn't. I think it was almost a year into it where we did sit down with the terms of agreement. How did we get through a whole, you know, year without having this sort of structure? It was odd to some of us who were a little more structure oriented, but it was successful, I think.
I always talk about the importance of a circle being designed so it gives each member energy. And I think one of the things I've discovered is it takes time to really learn and understand each other and get to the point where you really share about what's draining your energy and what would sort of really appeal to each member. It takes time.
Yeah, it does. Well, and you know, I just thought of something else or remember something else that in Alaska, summers are typically a time where everyone is outside doing something, gardening, hiking, boating. You know, it's a very active time of year. But we set out to and made a commitment that we would stick to our meetings for a 6-month period, and that commitment was really important, and I think it allowed us to take that time to get to know each other better and to you know, work through our own people styles, if you will, to get to know one another.
Yeah, it's really an investment. It takes time.
Yeah, but you're absolutely right that there. What needs to happen during these meetings is it needs to be fun. It needs to be something that gives people energy. It needs to be something that saves people's time, that's not more of a drag on people's time. And it needs to be something that really engages people's interest in what's going on. And,
right.
And that means making sure that the group is diverse enough that you know, you bring in people who are interested in different things, and that you fairly early on also decide what things you want to look at. And for our circle, we're very interested in self-sufficiency and food safety. Now, Alaska imports about 97% of its food, and that's shocking to people who live up here and don't know that or hear that for the first time. If you know, we were to have another 64 quake that took out the airport and the port and the roads, you know, we only have a few days' worth of food on hand in the stores to feed 375,000 people here just in Anchorage. So we're very interested, and it's very scary.
Right.
But, you know, it's not really a tangible until it happens.
Right.
Because you can go down to the store and still buy fresh, organic, you know, greens, leafy greens in January, and it doesn't. It, you know, it doesn't register with people that when they then go outside at 10 below that this is not something that came from our local farms. It's not something that we would normally be producing if it wasn't for the oil economy that facilitates this. So, you know, we're focused on trying to get more self-sufficient, both individually and as a group. And anyway, so having that as a focus really helps with keeping people's energy and people engaged, and it's terrific.
The part of a Solari circle is applying the sort of basic Solari philosophy, and there's a section after you formed the Alaska Solari Circle, we recorded Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, and the first part of that walks through the sort of 7 core principles of the Solari philosophy, and I'm not going to repeat that here, but 2 of them are really the concept of total economic return, and then one is intimacy, and of course both of those are part of sort of getting out of the bubble and getting back into real things. And really understanding where your money goes and what it does and its impact on human and living things, and using that knowledge to really find opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that I always encourage, now that we have the positioning recorded, is one of the ways to kick off is just going through the audio seminars and learning the basics together. In fact, it's one of the reasons we did the transcript. We found that groups like to read through them together. And the other thing is I encourage people, if one member has a salary report, to have the whole circle listen to it together. And it's one way to access the salary report that's more economic.
Right. Well, and one of the things that we did early on together was actually we had planned on listening to some of the audio seminars as a group. And individuals had listened to some of them. And we found that, you know, because of the different ways that people learn and communicate and work together, that it was actually more efficient for us. And this is, you know, what we did with the positioning is we took the write-up and walked through it. And
right.
That allowed folks who you know, want to stop and ask a question and sort of get clarity around a concept in the middle of it to do that and
right.
Do it comfortably. Whereas, you know, other people probably, you know, myself, I like to listen to things sort of all the way through and get a big picture overview and then go back to the details. But, you know, allowing or doing activities in a variety of ways to accommodate different people's learning styles is, I think, is really important. And, you know, ironically, and I was just talking with the circle yesterday, and one of the people said, you know, it really would have been helpful, I think, if we'd gone back or if we had listened to those audio seminars. and absolutely, and I think absolutely, taking every you know, other time to listen, and actually what we're doing now is we're listening collectively as a group to the Solari reports. And then
well, part of what I find, and you know, it's both with individuals and circles, is it's almost as though, you know, this sending your money to Wall Street and participating in the bubble and not knowing where it goes and what it does or understanding it in a concrete and grounded way, it's all part of sort of an entrainment. And it's almost like you're trying to, you know, win your mind out of a cult,
right.
If you will.
Right.
And to integrate the knowledge emotionally, it takes time.
Yeah.
It's not, so I don't think you can kind of just listen to it all and say, oh, okay, now I'm going to switch and do it, because you're talking about a very deep cultural change.
No, you can't. Yeah. It's over time. And you know, you've talked about it before, this, you know, this idea of creating a field.
Right.
Coming together and creating the field.
I think you're withdrawing from a field and building a new one.
Exactly. That's
right.
Exactly what we're doing. And we're doing that around food, having a good time, you know, providing support to each other, and helping each other understand sort of the concept of what the bubble economy is, and getting
right.
to understand what the tapeworm is and what that other field is about in a way that's safe and secure and allows us to collectively create a new way of being together.
Right. So money goes from something, you put it in the money machine and cha-ching, you get more money out, to or you get less money out,
right.
to money is a tool you use to create and build your world.
That's right. Well, and to talk about different types of wealth, you know, I mean,
right.
just the concept of wealth being something other than the money that you put into your 401k.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's a whole lesson in itself, and you could listen to audio seminar or speakers forever, but until you actually begin the process of transforming your wealth and money into the new economy, you don't get it. You know, it takes action to do it.
Right, and that brings us to coming clean, because
yeah.
in 1998, there's an article, if the subscribers haven't read it, there's a wonderful article called Coming Clean up on the Soleri website, and I think I linked it to it from the blog post on the nuts and bolts of organizing a Soleri circle. And it's a process that I started for myself in 1998, where I was sitting in my mansion in Washington writing a check on J.P. Morgan Chase Private Banking, and I said, oh, I think, why am I banking at the bank that's doing all this corruption? I think I need to come clean. And what I didn't understand is that coming clean is a journey that's never over.
That's right.
There's always more opportunity. And it's really important. You know, I felt, Michael, just a tremendous urgency to come clean. So I had this kind of, I ought to, I should, I ought to, you know, it's bad to do this. And finally I realized, no. You know, I need to come clean, and I need to sequence things in a way that gives me energy.
Yep.
You know, so, and in fact, as you come clean, the less dependent you are and the less connected you are financially or energetically to corrupt players, the better you feel. I mean, life gets safer. It gets more, because it's so energizing to come clean.
Yes.
But it takes a while, and it's, you know, it's complex, and everybody's different.
Well, and everyone's doing it at a different rate.
Right.
You know, it's amazing, even now, you know, some of our members are, you know, still banking at Wells Fargo.
Yes, and I want to talk to them about that.
You know, well, you know, I guess it's an important thing. I think there was somebody had put in on the blog, you know, you have to set your principles, or, you know, everybody has to be, I can't remember exactly what it was, but, you know, it was essentially drawing the line in the sand for, you know, what people have to do in order to become members. And we weren't like that. It's, you know, you do
right.
What you need to do that gives you energy, and we will go through this journey together, and if you want support in getting out, we're happy to, and we're going to be here for you. But we're not going to kick you out because you still bank at Wells Fargo.
Right.
You know, what's more important is to have you engaged and participate in this other stuff that we're doing. And, you know,
right. And people come clean in different ways, at different,
absolutely.
You know, they sequence it very differently.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and coming clean is something that we are still doing. We did some exercises at the beginning. We went through part of it. You know, one of the...
You went through the whole article step by step.
Well, we didn't go through the whole article step by step. We went through pieces of it.
Right.
We picked out parts of it. And, you know, one of the ones was going through, and we collectively talked about how many hours we spend, you know, doing quote-unquote wasteful things, like watching television or reading mysteries or commuting.
Uh-huh.
And we came up with 120 hours for the seven of us for a week.
Isn't that amazing?
80 hours a week that we could be doing.
That's three staff years. Okay,
yeah,
for seven people.
That's right.
That's three staff years.
Yes.
That's the equivalent of three people working full-time.
On moving into the real economy. Yeah. It was powerful. It was a really powerful moment for us when we recognized that. And, you know, even to look at, you know, my 20 hours or, you know, whatever it was and realize, you know, I can be using that time differently. But just to go through the process of thinking about how we spend our time and how we might use that differently was a really powerful experience.
Now, you can go through health, you can go through food, you can go
right.
through water, you can go through
Absolutely.
Energy,
yep.
you can go through deposits, investments, donations, all your purchases. So it's a you know, every aspect of your life is an opportunity to come clean.
And it's, like I said, it's still ongoing. I mean, we're all, I think, individually still working through different aspects of the coming clean process.
One of the most challenging things, whenever I go through the coming clean process, you know, to me, what I like to do is I like to identify my risk. What is my risk associated with health, with food, with water, with energy? And a lot of that is, where am I dependent on centralized systems? And it's very... it's very terrifying. That's why I don't like to do it alone.
Right.
And it's funny, you know, because the circle has gotten me going on so many different things I would never have gotten going on because it's just too terrifying to look at it. I just don't want to, you know, I'm the first, you know, I'm like Scarlett O'Hara. I'll think about it tomorrow.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes it really helps you know, to get the fear put into you, because that gets you off your duff and, you know, and gets you going on a whole bunch of things you never would have done without the circle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anything else before we go to education in action? Anything else you wanted to say on coming clean, Michael?
No, I think that wraps it. You know, I think the emphasis again is on doing it early, starting it early, identifying it. You know, certain aspects that you want to do as a group that are
right.
that are going to be empowering for folks, and then recognizing that you're not going to necessarily go through all of them as a group, or you might, if that's what the group wants to do, that's fine. But that it is a continual journey. And it is something that you can even go back to now and again and check in and say, hey, remember when we did this a year ago and we had 120 hours? Where are we now?
Right.
How are we doing?
Have you done another count?
No, we haven't. I just had that idea.
Yeah. Okay, well,
yeah.
We want to hear how you did. Okay, so
okay.
Education, step one is defining what everybody wants to learn. And this one is you know, every group is different. Because, you know, what 12 real estate brokers are going to need to know is very different than what, you know, 12 peace activists are going to want to know. So it's very, very different. How did your group define what they wanted to know?
Well, I think, again, you know, because we started out in sort of with the background of pioneers and understanding the shared principles that we came from. It was, and I guess in talking about what each of us cared about and what was important to us, we came to recognize that food security was a big one here in Alaska. You know, we talked
right.
about shared risks. We already talked about that. Food for us is a huge one. And to become more self-sufficient, especially at this, you know, this outpost in Alaska here, or this outpost that is Alaska, you know, food security and self-sufficiency rose to the surface above things like technology and, you know, that all other aspects tie into those two, but those were really, I think, the common thread that tied a number of our interests together.
And my impression of Alaska Celery Circle is you also had within your group a tremendous hunger to just get a good map of what was going on.
We haven't gone through a mapping the resources exercise,
right?
But we have, I guess, we've talked around it and sort of understand certain aspects of the resources that are coming into and going out of not just Anchorage but also the state. And you know, one of our planned guest speakers. Is the executive director of the local university's economic group.
Right, you have a fantastic group there in Anchorage.
And we would love to have him come and talk to us about what it is. And they've, you know, I've been in touch with them off and on over the year and, you know, occasionally get a report from them. They do a terrific job summarizing all that. All that information is out there. It's just amazing. When you take the time away from your mystery novel and you spend it doing a little bit of research about the flows, the economic resources in your community, you can find it. It's typically out there.
Well, I have a friend who lives in a fairly prosperous or what's thought of as a fairly wealthy neighborhood up in Ohio, and her church started a group for people who've been laid off or were unemployed and were looking for work. And this group is exploding in size. And one of the things I said to her, I said, you know, there are no jobs. We're going to have to invent, we're going to have to create the jobs. And so rather than sit around and talk about how you find jobs, you guys ought to start mapping your local financial ecosystems. Because, you know, we saw it, I addressed this when I spoke to pioneers in Alaska. If you look at the state money pool, so you look at the pension funds and you look in Alaska, we've got something called the Permanent Fund, which invests the oil profits that are to go to all the citizens. So the citizens are the beneficiaries. Between the permanent fund and the pension funds, Alaska's shipping huge amounts of money to Wall Street and taking huge losses on it. I mean, that's what we're seeing is all this capital that hasn't been available for communities or local small business has been literally going down the drain in big corporate and bank stocks. And if you look at the whole system of a county or a region, the reality is if we pull up all our capital and send it to Wall Street and it never comes back, there are no jobs. So somebody's got to dig in, and this group is full of incredible professionals. Somebody's got to dig in and start reengineering that money back.
Yeah. Well, and here in Alaska, it's even more of a heartache that we're taking so much of our natural resources, actual physical wealth, and shipping it and turning it into paper and digital assets that have no basis in reality at all. And
right.
It's
you're selling the real economy and buying into the bubble.
Right, exactly.
Right. Well, one of the things I'm scheduled to do sometime in late spring or summer is we're doing a Solari report called Mapping Local Financial Ecosystems, and that's really to help folks who've never grappled with, okay, how do I sit down and find the data and find all the information and start looking at it? But it's amazing. I've never, and if you go to the Solari blog under Get Data, you'll see a whole bunch of links that'll get you started if you don't want to wait. But it's funny, I'll never forget, I've done this a couple times, going over to Franklin Sanders Farm, and here's Franklin, who's so knowledgeable about money and the economy, and I'll get him on websites that show how the money works in his county or the state of Tennessee, and he's just floored. He can't believe, he's like, what? And if you could get enough people in a place literate about where all this money is going and how it works,
right,
there's incredible opportunities because, if you get enough prominent citizens walking in, and, a government official can't say, look, I want to spend four times more than it costs. You can't do that. I mean, you just can't do it. It's not politically feasible, and it's not legal.
Right. Well, and you bring up an important, an important topic. How does a circle go about becoming knowledgeable? What are some of the tools that are out there? And, of course, the Solari website has been absolutely critical to our education on the real economy. But there are a number of other, we've used other, some of us follow Gata, and
right.
Some of us are regular Kitco junkies. So the internet, of course, is a huge resource.
Right. I think one phase of starting a circle is really talking about what are the best sources of news.
Right.
And what we found in our circle, first we talked about, what are the best sources. We shared sources. We started looking at all the sources. And then what we realized over time was different people were reading different things,
mm-hmm.
and we looked to each other to be a source.
Right.
So now, once a week, we have a fabulous treasurer, Paul Ferguson, and he gives a report on sort of money. He does a money and market report on the circle. And then we go around the circle and everybody reports about what they're seeing in their economy, in their place, and sort of different, and they're reading different things. And so we started to see each other as sources.
That's terrific.
Yeah, it's wonderful when that happens because, 10 people reading, all actively reading and watching what's going on in their place and then sharing, there's tremendous, just tremendous knowledge. And of course, they're all now sending me their great sources for the blog. So when you look at the top picks you're seeing, you're definitely seeing first ever Solari Circle go to work.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say that's a great example of getting a regional sense for it. And I think, for us, the individuals bring in, we all bring in information based on our own interests, and so we're able to educate each other in areas that we may not otherwise be getting information.
And it's different points of view. Another thing I wanted to mention, I don't think you've done it, but we didn't, and that is creating a mock portfolio.
We did actually create a mock portfolio.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah. And it was a really an excellent exercise to go through. You know, we used the quadrant methodology, and I think we didn't do a million. Maybe we did 100,000.
Okay.
Or maybe we did do the million. And and walked through the global liquid, global non-liquid, the liquid local, and the non-liquid local, and set up an investment portfolio. And just in doing that, it was a terrific education.
Right. You learn a lot about working with money together, but there's no risk.
Exactly. Well, for those who didn't necessarily know what, how a bond worked, or, what's a CD?
Right.
And different pools of money in which you can invest. And the concept of, I remember sort of struggling with the concept of local versus global. And, it's not actually global in the bubble economy sense of it, but it's global local.
Right. It's lots of other locals.
Right, right.
So
it's
interacting with enterprises and people all over the world without going through big centralized governments or corporations or banks. So you're doing local, but you're doing it relationally.
Right.
So it's lots of local instead of just your local.
And it was really funny. I remember specifically when we were going through what local non-liquid could be, and it was like, it's a farm in Costa Rica.
Right.
One of the members got really excited about that and started looking for real estate.
Let's all get together and get a hideaway.
Yeah, exactly. It was just.
Well, the hideaway. I've always believed the hideaway is a great way for circles to interact because people are worried and want to have, a second place, but they don't want to all buy one. So the idea of a group of people getting together and pooling a hideaway makes tremendous sense. So I'm waiting for that to happen. another thing I wanted to mention is Economics 101 is a curriculum I wrote a long time ago for my local pastor has high school kids, and he asked me to write a curriculum for his high school kids. So, I have no idea how to write a curriculum, but that never stops me, and I wrote it. And I realized after I wrote it, this is what most adults in America need because we never got this education. And it's really on understanding economics and using your local area to understand economics.
Yeah.
And that's a tool that's up on the Solari website as well. You've said this before, Michael, but I want to stress again the importance of building your vocabulary.
Absolutely.
I think it's so important because many people in America, they'll talk to their broker, they'll talk to different people in the financial community, and those people end up using so many words. And I'm guilty of this because I'm from the financial world. So many words that you don't understand, and if a conversation is allowed to continue when people don't understand the fundamental words being used, then it kind of falls apart. And so stopping and taking time to learn definitions is great. There are a variety of different glossaries you can use, printed glossaries, dictionaries for financial terms, but this is where I think Wikipedia has just made an enormous difference. And
yep.
I have an attorney who goes crazy every time I say that because he says, oh, it's not precise in this and that, but I think it's wonderful.
If all you're going to it for are sort of general terms, then I think it's a fairly safe resource.
Right. It's pretty good.
One of the things that in terms of building your vocabulary, there's really two areas that people who are new to the financial world are that we need to build, and this is what we found. One is getting a better understanding about all of the bubble economy terms, so we can understand some of the vehicles and the way that the bubble economy is being manipulated and worked. And then the other is creating the vocabulary to understand and build the real economy.
Right.
And so it's, I think some of us in the circle have struggled with, should we go take a class and understand finance, take some sort of an introductory finance class And then we realized, no, I don't think so. I think
no, because you're going
to...
There's so much misinformation threaded through.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so programmed that I just think that a group of people like the Alaska Celery Circle, it's faster and less expensive to do it yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we have found, too.
And you found when you've invited people to come speak...
Oh, that's a terrific resource.
Right.
Yeah.
People are pretty eager to come... you know, address a group of seven.
Yes, and again, you know, we have a long list of things of to-dos, and one of them is to actually have some of the local bank representatives come and tell us about their banks, so that we can figure out, you know, for those who still need to move into a local bank. How to do it and which one to pick.
Right. I don't know a banker in this world who, if you told him you had seven accounts ready to move, would not love to roll out the boardroom for you.
Yeah. Well, not only seven accounts, but potentially one group account, too.
Right. Right.
And, you know,
okay, so taking action, and this is always an area for me that's, you know, there's so many potential, there's thousands of potential actions, and it really comes down to where you're heart is and what you're interested in and whether you're place-based or, like us, phone-based. But after you've come clean and you've gotten educated, and we know the education goes on forever. It's not...
Yeah. Just sometimes the curve is steeper in parts than others.
Right. Let's talk about some of the actions that a circle can take before the big investment step.
Developing economic resilience is a big one that you know we're working on, and really we look at that both personally and as a household or as a group. And then, just as an example, you know, going out and doing what you mentioned before, buying up tangibles and
right,
laying in a good stock.
Boy, and that's a much bigger job than I ever thought.
It is. And, you know, especially if you're like us and you live in a small house.
Right.
I think the first step is going to be to actually clear out some room under the house in order to store some of the stuff.
Right.
But then doing it as a group, too. And, you know, one of the things that has come up is converting one of our members has a shed in their backyard.
Right. I just talked to somebody today. There's a group that you know, one did it, and then the second started to do it. It's kind of like the 100 monkey syndrome. Finally, they said, hey, listen, why don't we buy a shed, and why don't we aggregate our purchases so we can get much better prices and buy wholesale?
Right.
So they're off and running.
Well, and then, you know, to then go from the group to the community, one of the things, you know, we've come up with a few ideas of activities that we would like to do, or at least look into, and one of them is the idea of a community cold house, a community root or vegetable storage. And
right,
that's something that a Celery group could do as an action.
We got a really good question on the precious metals update with Franklin. Someone had talked about how much higher the transaction costs were for buying precious metals,
mm-hmm,
in small amounts, which is
right,
a very good point. And one of the things I said, which I've always believed could really get going, is a circle is very appropriate to help people learn how to invest in precious metals,
yeah,
particularly if they don't have a lot of money. One, it's a lot, you know, learning how to invest in precious metals, I find, is, you know, it's a new and strange world, and there's a lot to learn. And it's fun to do it together. But the other thing is there's something called a partnership or hand, which can be very powerful. It's really a way of saving together. It was brought to America by a lot of the different immigrant groups. What they do is, so you have, say, 10 people, and you, let's say you meet once a week, and you create a number that you're going to save. Let's say you're going to do $25 a week, or, you know, the equivalent of $100 a month. You come to 10 people come together, $100 a month, you put it in the pot, and then one person takes it. And it's a way for people to aggregate money to buy a car or, you know, a down payment on a home or things like that. It's very important to trust each other and to have a sort of somebody, the designated banker, because obviously if one person, you know, gets the $1,000 and then doesn't show up for the next 9 months, you know, everybody suffers. So you need a high degree of ethics and competency. And what has been found with a lot of groups who did this is over time you have the magic of compound interest working for you because your money's in your network instead of sitting in the bank. And believe it or not, in the securities and financial industry, float, which is the interest earnings on balances, is one of the greatest sources of revenue. So I was on Wall Street for 11 years. For those 11 years, float was the biggest source of our earnings. That's, of course, we weren't reporting fraud, honestly, but float's a very important ingredient in building wealth. And so these kinds of savings clubs can be very powerful. And if you combine them with precious metals, then what it allows you to do is if you're buying $100 a month, you're paying very high transaction costs. If everybody can pool this way and one person get the coin, then you're going to pay much lower transaction costs. And you're going to have a group of people to help you really learn and get savvy about a new area that I think is going to grow, you know, only grow in importance. You know, but it also applies to self-sufficiency things. I mean, imagine you all get together, put $100 in the pot, and then you can start to buy farm equipment or other things that normally would seem, you know, seem overwhelming. I just bought a generator. It's expensive. So you know, there's a way of aggregating purchases or, you know, or other things with when you combine it with a savings club. And another one that's very important is paying down debt. I don't know whether the Alaska Solidarity Circle looked at that.
No, we haven't. You know, what I like about all these things that we're talking about is that it's action that's before finance. You don't actually have to, you know, create an LLC to do it. You don't have to get into the potentially more complicated investment tools in order to do this.
Right. Well, there's a lot of loans, and if you look at angel networks, they just get together. You know, they share information and knowledge, but when they write checks, they just each write their own check and individually have a business relationship with whatever business they invest in.
Right.
Well, so there's no pooling of capital whatsoever.
Right. Right. Well, one of the things that we did do to take action is some scenario planning, and that was an activity that we did as part of our coming clean and moving our individual assets over into out of the tapeworm economy and into a more real economy.
Right, and you know, from if you've listened to Position Your Assets, I described seven areas of opportunity and then seven scenarios,
mm-hmm.
And I think it is so important if you're going to manage your time or your money, it is essential to do scenario planning and sort of live emotionally in your imagination through what that world would look like. And I have to say, scenario planning by yourself is impossible.
Well,
and a lot of these scenarios are scary, so doing it with other people is so much more wonderful.
Well, for us as a group, it was after we had gone through it, and it took us, I think, about 3 weeks to really go through each person's individual portfolio.
Right.
And, you know, using scenario planning to do that. Okay, well, what if this, and what if that, and what if this? Okay, so, you know, let's look into putting some here and some there based on this scenario, and some here and some there based on that scenario. Okay, that looks good. And then talking about, after that, where's our fear? Because there was a lot of fear that kept sort of bubbling up
right. In
the conversation about these different scenarios and what that looked like. And to be able to do that in a group, it got dark at one point. And
right. And you know, but it's you kind of
really dynamically,
right.
It was difficult. But as a group, we were able to, at the end, okay, let's pull it back together here. And let's realize that we've gone into that very dark and scary place, and we've prepared for it, And now we don't have to worry about it. It doesn't have to be in the back of our mind all the time, you know, in the way that it would be if we hadn't walked down that road together.
Right. And one of the things, I don't know if you've done disaster recovery planning, but I've done disaster recovery planning with my local. I have a local sustainability circle here in the county. It doesn't, sometimes we deal with money, but generally we're dealing with very local sustainability issues. And doing disaster recovery plan in a group, in a circle, is so, I mean, it's so much better. And because you do, you have to get into things that are very dark. I live in a tornado area, and so doing it with others made a huge difference to me. And it's very, one of the things I found, it's invaluable for not having to worry about things, but also just managing your assets properly.
Yeah.
So I really encourage disaster recovery planning because it you know, it just works. It really works. Well, on taking action, any other comments you wanted to make or ideas you wanted to discuss before we close, Michael?
No, I think that was it for taking action. You know, we're really looking forward to, I guess, doing more education and getting a deeper understanding of what it's going to be like to move on to the next step. And I think a lot of these things that we've talked about in terms of taking action have been fun and fairly easy to do, and have been very beneficial for us individually and collectively. And didn't require that structure or the complexities of actually getting into group financing.
Now, as we close, let me just ask you, as we've watched the financial sort of centralized systems become more and more unreliable and also become more and more grabby in terms of power and control, has the circle or the dynamic and energy of the circle sort of benefited from the message coming back from the environment saying you really need to do this? Has the logic of doing what you're doing become a lot more compelling as the environment changes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, we got into this in November 2007, and, you know, things were still rosy. You know, the outlook was still terrific as far as anyone knew. And it has been quite a journey to walk through these times together, and I think that we've all grown a deep appreciation for the community that we've developed, and also, you know, see this as even more of an imperative to not just develop and grow our circle and strengthen the circle, but also to increase the length of our tendrils out into our community and really begin to be actively involved in what we see around us.
Right, and I really believe that if you look at so many of the actions a circle can take, if you have lots of circles self-organizing within a place, then the options grow exponentially because they make each other powerfully. You know, there are more things they can do with each other and encourage each other and team up to do.
Well, and I really just want to say before we close that this can seem scary and frightening to take the step towards organizing with other people and talking about your finances and exposing a part of yourself that our society does not, you know, it's something that is really not looked favorably upon. It's not something that's a learned behavior in the U.S. And I think it's really important that we take the courage to do that and really commit to doing it and recognize that we don't have to be financially savvy to do it.
Right.
You know, my experience before this was, you know, I had a 401k. I had a couple of other little investment, you know, some land, but I did not have the vocabulary or the background to do this. And after going through over a year now of this process, I'm totally blown away. I'm actually, you know, trying to get somebody to help us go through some due diligence on a 300-acre dairy farm. You know, a year ago, I never would have thought that this is something that I would be able to or interested or capable.
Well, the thing that was so powerful to me is you said, I'm looking for somebody to help me do due diligence on recapitalizing a local dairy farm. And so I wrote an email to the group in Vermont. There's a wonderful organic farming group in Vermont. And I just, you know, I said to Willie, I said, could you help the guys in Alaska on doing, you know, and wham, now we've got somebody with decades of experience who's just fantastic.
Well,
and the excitement from him about helping you,
right?
It was wonderful. So I think, you know, when local investors and local farmers start to realize that they can get in cahoots, you know, that's when things are going to get pretty fun.
Yeah, well, and developing that network and not being afraid to take the steps to put a circle together and just sticking with it, really, really important. And it just pays off, huge dividends.
It does. But I should warn it. I think I'm in summary, I'd like to just give a warning, which is this is a decision. To do a circle is something that takes a steady and regular investment. You are building a new field, and so it takes time, and it takes investment, and it takes really a faithfulness, and because you're learning to work with people in a way that you may not have worked with them before. So this is not something to take lightly, and when you do it, you want to organize it in a way that really gives you energy. So you need to think long and hard about what it is that's going to give you energy and who's going to give you energy and organize it accordingly. And I think if you do that, you'll be very gratified at what can come out of it. So, Michael, before we close, anything else you'd like to say in summary?
No, I think that was it.
Okay. Well, we appreciate everything you're doing in Alaska. And we appreciate everything the Celery Circle is doing. And so thank you so much, Michael, and have a wonderful evening.
You're welcome. Thank you. It's really been my pleasure. And thank you for creating the opportunity for folks to participate in Celery and grow their own Celery Circles. It's terrific. Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay, so in closing, ladies and gentlemen, let me say again, you are, as always, in our prayers. We look forward to being with you, not next week. Next week, we don't have a Celery report. The next Celery report is Thursday, April 2nd, for our quarterly wrap-up. At the end of 2008, we did our year-end wrap-up. I expect to have a quarterly wrap-up, three quarters coming into the year-end wrap-up each year. And so quarterly wrap-up, we'll take a look at you know, how far we're through the shakeout, where we've been, where we're going, what the outlook's going to be for the big questions, the dollar, and what the pro-centralization team has been up to. So quarterly wrap-up, April 2nd. The following week is our monthly with Precious Metals and Franklin Sanders. We're going to be looking at the movie The International with Clive Owens. It's still in theaters in most areas, and I really encourage you to watch it. It's not necessarily the most entertaining movie, but it's a excellent, really outstanding fictional depiction of why the corruption is so systemic and ingrained, and the role of debt in being used to, they show debt being used to control countries and to be used to extract subsidies from countries in the sort of central banking warfare model. That model applies to not just countries, but counties and places. So if you want to understand the business model that's draining your community, it's right there in The International. So I really encourage you to watch it. And then April 16th, we're going to be speaking with Dmitry Orlov, the author of Reinventing Collapse. Dmitry is a software developer who was Russian, moved to the United States, but kept going back to Russia and seeing sort of what happened as the economy went through very dramatic and radical transformation after the Soviet Union broke down. So April 16th, Dmitry Orlov, Reinventing Collapse. I wanted to point out again, we had it in your subscriber update, but there is, thanks to your feedback, we have posted a subscriber access link to the control panel on each, it's on the navigation bar on the Solari site. So wherever you are on the Solari website, you can just look up in the navigation bar and click right to the control panel. And I wanted to thank you for your suggestions. We've gotten a lot of fantastic, not just questions, but suggestions on how we can improve the Solari report and make it more relevant and more useful to you. So keep those suggestions coming, because we love to improve, and we love to follow up, and we love to be useful to you. So again, until April, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one, and hopefully tonight helped you a little bit. If your conspiracy is going to be a Solari circle, hopefully we can help you kickstart that Solari circle. So good night, and good luck.